Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast, hosted by Renita Ray Davis, licensed clinical social worker, board-approved social work clinical supervisor, and facilitator of the Goddesses of Social Work supervision community. Join us as we travel through the social work journeys told by the Goddesses of Social Work community members, past and present, as they make their way toward clinical licensure.
Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. On today's episode, Dr. Julie Lance, LCSW, joins the show. Dr. Julie Lance is a licensed clinical social worker, a registered play therapist supervisor, RPT/S, and a contributing faculty member for the Master of Social Work program at Walden University. Dr. Lance is employed as the school social worker, providing direct social work and mental health services to students and their families. Her passion is helping children as well as their families increase both their social and emotional well-being. She began her career as a medical social worker at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, providing social support and discharge planning to patients. She continued in the medical arena, working with children and families in both pediatric and neonatal medical units, as well as working as an ER social worker for Children's Healthcare of Atlanta at Scottish Rite. Her research interests include the collective efficacy of interdisciplinary teams in public school settings, focusing on a common commitment to implement mental health services in school systems. Additionally, she is interested in the educational practices and outcomes of students entering their field placements in social work. She received her Bachelor of Social Work degree from Appalachian State University, a Master of Social Work degree from Alabama A&M University, and a PhD from the Institute for Clinical Social Work. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lance.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're so glad you're here. Julie, what did you want to be when you were growing up? Or who did you want to be most like when you were growing up?
You know, my mom was a teacher. And so I always got to go into work early with her and stay after school when she was like getting her classroom and everything cleaned up. And all of her friends were teachers. So it was something that I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to be with kids. I want to be in the classroom. That's what I want to do. So that was sort of always in my mind. Like I never thought I want to be a doctor or a vet or a, well, you know, anything beyond just kind of a helping profession, I guess. You know, of course, at that time, I had zero clue what social work was, had no interactions with that. So that's sort of where I guess my foundation started.
I love that. And to see that you're now teaching, we're going to get into your social work journey, but you ended up teaching anyway, yep. Right? Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. What an honor, or what an amazing mama she must have been in order for you to want to be a teacher.
Yes, she's wonderful. She really is. I'm fortunate to still have her with me. And she's a great source to just bounce ideas off of and always gives guidance.
Yeah, I love that. Even as a at the university level, you think that the teaching energy of advice that she's able to give, it still resonates?
I think so. But, you know, honestly, it was my dad that really pushed me more to getting my PhD. He always said to me, you got to go get your letters, go get your letters. And so unfortunately, he passed away before my graduation from my doctoral program. But my family got me some jewelry, and one earring says BSW, one says MSW, and the necklace says PhD, because they were like, you got your letters. So I wear my letters all the time in honor of my dad. But the reason that I say that was because he was always interested in the world around him, always wanted to know more, always wanting to learn. And I remember telling him when I was doing field directing, and it was my first job really after my PhD program. And he said, so what do you think about teaching? And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when I talk, they're listening to me. And he said, don't you ever forget that. And remember that what you're saying, people are listening to you and learning from you. And that's always really stuck with me.
I love that. It sounds like you had some amazing parents, and they raised a social worker.
They did.
Pretty cool. Yeah. I love parents who raise social workers. And in fact, let's talk about that. You can start wherever you want to. I have so many questions after reading your bio, but instead of me jumping into that, I was like, let me let you just tell your social work journey. And then if we get into it, I'll ask the questions about your bio. What started you out on this journey?
If I really have to think back, I was fortunate enough when I was younger to live overseas. I lived in Saudi Arabia when I was in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And we did an incredible amount of traveling all over the world. I saw countries in Africa, all over Europe, and you know, the Middle East and everything. And that really helped to form and shape my view on the world. And when we came back to the States, I was young, seventh grade, but I felt like I had already outgrown my peers because they were just, you know, all in this little world, and I had already seen and experienced so much. So my big global picture has been a part of me since I was, you know, 12 years old. So the things that I saw and the things that I experienced made me realize, you know, the world is bigger than me, and I want to, you know, help people, because I did see a lot. You know, when you go to Kenya and you're hanging out in downtown Nairobi, I mean, you see, I mean, the discrepancies and the differences and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being a part of something that was different and to see how I could be a part of that and what I could do to be a part of that.
I love that so much. I am a military brat, and I'm proud to say I'm a military brat. And so I'm not sure if you were there for military reasons or others, but I do think traveling outside of just traveling, it doesn't mean yes. Just, yeah, traveling. And you know what? Because you and I kind of graduated around this, we've been doing this a long, long, long time. And one of the cool things that I see picking up a lot, because I have, I think, seven or eight social workers that I have the honor of supervising who are travel social workers. And them just them coming back and talking about how different the experiences are in each state that they're traveling in is even just more expansive than what I grew up in the social work field.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you knew you wanted to help people because of this expansive mindset that you have that I think is so beautiful and speaks to a lot in your bio with the diverse experience that you've had. So then how did you end up at Appalachian State? Am I saying that right? Because I love
it's Appalachian State. You have to say it with a North Carolina way.
I love it.
I actually grew up in North Carolina on the coast in Wilmington. And Boone is, what? You grew up in Wilmington?
No, but my family is from Wilmington, North Carolina. My mother was born and raised in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, I graduated from New Hanover High School.
I cannot wait to share that with her. I know, let's get back. You were raised in Wilmington. That is so cool.
So, Appalachian. I had an older sister that was there, but Boone is pretty much as far away as you can get from Wilmington with staying in state. So that was kind of my drive. It's like, I've got to get out of here. In fact, I graduated from high school a year early. I pushed myself through summer school and night school because I was done. I was ready for the next adventure. And that sort of has driven my social work career as well. But the idea of social work and the knowledge of social work as a profession, I never knew anything about it until probably going into my junior year in college. I was still floating around, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to major in? And I just took this intro to social work class and everything just started clicking for me. It made sense to me. It made me excited. And there had been no other classes that were like that for me. And then when I started investigating a little bit more and saw the versatility of just having the degree and the different things that you could do with it, it just seemed, it spoke to me.
And you have done a lot of different things in your career. Now, Julie, did you go straight back to get your MSW, or did you, the undergraduate is in
And is
Right,
that
because you had the
social work?
BSW, yeah.
I am
So,
BSW.
yeah.
So I graduated in 95 with my BSW and had a year where I tried to work. And, that's always a tough year, right? When you graduate, I went home with my parents were living in Florida at the time. And I just kept thinking, this is not where I need to be, not where I want to be. And kind of floated around, and one of my good friends from college had moved to Huntsville, Alabama. And I was like, hey, want a roommate? So booked it up there and, with no plans in mind. And that's when I started doing a little bit more research and saw that Alabama A&M was doing their inaugural MSW class and program. So I'm like, oh, that's what I'm going to do because I had advanced standing. So I knew it was only going to take me a year to get that MSW. So I was like, I'm on it. Let's go ahead. Let's do this. Let's move forward. Yeah.
I love that I have the honor of asking you this. I've had the honor of asking African American women what their HBCU experience was like. And now to be able to ask you, it feels very diverse to be able to ask you, what was your HBCU experience like?
I think mine's probably a little bit different because,
Yeah.
when you're in a master's program, you're not as embedded in the school culture for sure. We're in our own little world, but it was a beautiful campus. The offerings that the school had were, wonderful. I mean, all of the different majors, the amenities, the clubs, and although I didn't take part of any of that because I was too busy to, but I was really just impressed with the vibrancy, I think is a good word for the campus and the energy that came from it. And it was really motivating to just sort of be around that positive. You could feel it. People were wanting to better themselves, wanting to do more with life.
I love that. Before we hit record, you were speaking of a couple of professors or advisors that really were impactful. I would love to hear a little bit more about that. Who was the most impactful person during your experience at A&M?
When I started, Dr. Mel Henry was the director of the MSW program. And he was the most gentle soul. He really was. He had this calming voice. He actually, I don't know if it was he was impressed with me or took pity on me, but I was his research assistant. So I could get, a stipend to kind of get through school. He was just, very supportive and just, what do you need? So he's always really stuck with me.
I love that. And so then you get your MSW. Do you go straight into licensing, or do you work? Talk to me about what your next steps were.
So the roommate that I had when I moved to Alabama, who was a good friend in college, turned out to be my husband. We did not plan that. We were only friends. So my graduation day was actually my wedding day as well. So I didn't attend my MSW graduation because I was wearing white walking down the aisle that day, which was fine. I made that choice. But he had just gotten into graduate school at Georgia State University. So we're like, okay, well, let's do that. So armed with my MSW, and we moved to Atlanta and started throwing resumes out there, seeing what was going to happen. I didn't immediately go for an LMSW. Honestly, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, what direction I wanted to take, and what all of that would entail. So I got my LMSW probably about a year or so later. It wasn't necessary at the time for the jobs I wanted.
Right. You know what? I often tell this story. I was 10 years postmaster's before I got my LMSW. Back then, they called it an LGSW because I think sometimes, especially there's so much push, I guess, in the part of social work I'm in to work on licensure and, obviously get the clinical, which both of us have our clinical. Yay, do that. It works out for you. But I think we forget there how much value there is just with the MSW, and that you can work amazing jobs with your MSW degree without having, go into that LMSW.
And I was fortunate with the job that I took right after my master's program because I got clinical supervision at work. So I didn't have to do anything extra for it. So that was a a motivator, I guess, to stay there because I knew I was getting something that I couldn't afford to do otherwise. So it was nice just to get that experience and have that guidance right there on the job.
Now, was this at Grady? Because I cannot wait to hear about
it. Was at Grady.
Yeah, Grady is like all on TV and movies. And obviously, I lived in Atlanta, so I know that it feels like a hardcore place to be. And yet you did it and
so
stayed.
I got to tell you, though. So I had never lived in Atlanta. And like I said, that was the time where you just mail resumes out. You know, it was, that's all it was. You look in the newspaper, you see postings, you mail things out. And they were one of the ones that got back to me. I had no idea what Grady was. No idea. I was like, I know I want to work in a hospital. Yay, a hospital contacted me. So I'm, 23 years old. This old white girl bebopping down in downtown Atlanta. And then I start, going, I'm like, oh, okay. So this is it's a very different world. And you roll with it. And I loved it because every minute of every day, there was something new that was going on. That's why I always loved the medical field, but not only with learning from the residents and the nurses, but also the patients that were there and their life experiences was, nothing that I personally had experienced. And to be able to see that and help and, just be exposed to that was, you can't trade that experience.
I think that your childhood experience in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade of being out of the country, being and living and experiencing Africa, that must have really been foundational for you to go to Appalachian State, for you to go to Alabama A&M, for you to go to, for your first job, Grady Memorial Hospital. Not being afraid to do the hard thing just seems like a theme for you in your social work career.
Right. I mean, it was just, you do what you got to do. It seemed interesting. So let's just move forward with it. And it was a great place. It really was. I call it my dog years because 1 year at Grady is 7 years in normal years. So.
I agree. Is there a memorable, because, by the way, Social Work Month, happy Social Work Month to you. But, the NASW theme this year is talks, when I was reading the proclamation, because I can't remember the theme, it was long this year. But it talks about social workers being on the front line of some of the toughest crises this nation has ever faced. And, I'm asking people, what are some of your frontline stories? And so being at Grady Hospital, I can only imagine you have a memorable frontline story.
I don't know if the language is clean enough for your podcast, things that I've seen and heard. To back up, I did two tours of duty at Grady. So I started there, I left, and then I went back. And everybody thought I was insane for going back. I'm like, no, I got to go back. This is something I want. But I do remember my second round there is when I was working in the neonatal intensive care unit. And partway through my time there, I was pregnant with my first child. And one of the mothers that I was working with noticed, because I was not showing it, but she finally was like, oh my, she's like, is this your first baby? And I was like, yeah, it's my first baby. She's like, is it the dad's first baby? And I was like, it is. She's like, oh, that's wonderful. But that was not a question that ever occurred to me that anybody would ever ask me. But it was just, that's what it was, it was just different experiences for sure. Different conversations that I've never had before.
Absolutely. Which are so normal.
Yeah.
Which are so normal. So you did two tours. I loved how you said that at Grady, and you've done all of this work. You're at Grady getting your clinical supervision, I'm assuming.
Yep.
And so one of my favorite questions is asking, what was your licensing test experience like for you? Was
My licensing test, well, first of all, when you have to get all of your paperwork and signed by your supervisors, and I had called my supervisor at Grady, set up a time to go down there so she could sign off on all of my paperwork. She passed away the day before I went down there, which was devastating on many, many levels. But that also made it a more difficult process just to get the application done, because then you have to do a whole separate form of death of supervisor. And so that it was very anxiety ridden just from the get-go, because that's when you just want to get it done. You just want to have everything in there and just mail it in. So it was sort of like it kind of threw me a little bit. And then of course there's that waiting period of, are they going to approve me? Or are they not going to approve me? When I took my licensure exam was in 2001, and it was just after 9/11, and I was pregnant with my first child at that time. So it's a blur. It really is. I do remember studying for it, and it's a nerve-wracking test because there's no real right answer. It's like the best one, and that threw me a lot. And I remember flagging all of these questions and then going, why did I do that? Because now I'm second guessing myself. So don't second guess yourself. Don't flag unless you really want to go back to it. Otherwise you'll change answers. But so I was glad when it was done, for sure. But I also knew that, I wasn't sure why I was getting it. It was like just the next natural step. I was like, okay, so I've been doing this. I guess I got the supervision, I guess. But I didn't want to do private practice. I didn't want to, do direct therapy. That didn't interest me at all at the time. But I'm like, if I get it, they can't take it away from me. So might as well just go ahead and get it. So that's what I did.
I love that. They can't, I say that often. Get it, they can't take it away from you. And then it also opens up so many doors, and you get to decide which door you want to go through. You don't necessarily have to go through a clinical door. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You
Absolutely.
know, I remember the Georgia board rules about supervision and having to, oh, I can only imagine, Julie, how difficult that was for you in regards to having to do that extra work after that happened. Yeah. And I'm so sorry too that she passed
Well,
away.
thank you for that. Thank you. I learned a lot from her. I really did. So,
And it reminds me to say to social workers and to us, make sure you're taking really good care of yourself, because this career is hard. And so self-care is so important.
Absolutely. And no, when you're done, just go ahead and get your paperwork done and just move on with, don't linger. Just go ahead and get it done.
Get it in, and then when you're ready to, you could take it. Yes, I
Right.
appreciate you saying that. Yes, just go ahead and get it in. I love that. And so, Julie, I know one of the things you do now, you're still in the school system as a school social worker,
I
right?
am. I am. Go ahead. Well, I stayed in the hospitals for a while. And it was, just kind of a fluke that I wound up in the school system, from just the interns that I had in the hospital. I had a couple of them that went to the school system, and when something opened up, they were like, hey, what do you think? And at that point, I had first baby. And the first thing that comes in my mind is that would be a really nice schedule to have with kids. Not that I was necessarily interested in the schools, because I loved the medical arena, loved it. It was just, it's an exciting place to be. You're always learning something. It's just fast paced. It's just a great place. But the transition over to school social work, it just made sense at the time.
Yeah, I've been waiting to ask this question. And then you're in the school system, and you, with your overachieving self, decide to become a registered play therapist. I wanted to ask you this question because I do have social workers who often say they're interested in becoming a registered play therapist, but they often say how difficult it is to do the, to get all of the requirements done. And so you got it done. And not only did you get it done, you became a registered play therapist supervisor. So I wondered, could you take a couple of minutes to just walk us through that process? And why did you decide to do it? And has it been worth it for you?
It sort of fell into my lap is what happened. So when I first started with the schools, I was just a direct school social worker. And then my supervisor got a federal grant through the Success for All Students federal grant to put school-based mental health in a certain area of schools that really did not have mental health providers or public transportation to get to them. So there was a group of us that started providing direct therapeutic services, which is where the LCSW came in handy. You know, I already had it, did not worry about it. But as we were doing that, one of the things that was written into the grant was to do the play therapy training. And we had all of this extra money to set up playrooms and, you know, all of that kind of good. So it just sort of fell into my lap of, hey, this would be a cool thing to do as well. And to, I always look, you know, a few years forward. Okay, so where do I want to be in a few years from now? Like, I'm content where I am, but I know I'm going to want to do something different. And that just kind of helps me not get stuck. So when we started going through all the training and everything, I mean, it was, I didn't have to pay for it, which was a bonus as well. It was kind of embedded into my work in what I was doing. And I just kept with it because it made sense, again, just to keep with it. And then with the RPTS, I just started looking into that as well. I'm like, oh, I can do that. I have all of those qualifications. So let me just go ahead and do that paperwork. And, you know, it's because again, it's, they can't take it away from you. If you have it, do it. And then you can figure out what you want to do from there. So right now in my county, I am the only RPT social worker. There are some counselors that are. I was the first to do that, and I'm the only RPTS that I'm aware of in the county, in the schools. There are a couple of colleagues right now that are going through the process of getting their RPT, which is wonderful because it just makes sense in the arena that we work in to have that extra training.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the conversations that here in Alabama we've been talking about. Some of the social workers who are working not in the school systems, you know, maybe foster care and adoption with the Medicaid programs, they're looking for a registered play therapist, but can't find, there's none available, and especially none who also have the social work background as well. And so it seems like you are filling a needed gap for a population that absolutely needs access to this particular service.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If you could see my office, it's a whole playroom. It's a whole thing going on in there. And the kids love going in there because it's a respite from the classroom. It's just something different. They don't have to talk if they didn't want to go in there, but I'm always watching and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on in your head there? What are you grabbing? What are you drawing? What are you doing? And it just is, it's an easy relief for them.
I love that. I'm like, I want to see your office. I love, but then is this where Sister, even though she's on your bio, I'm aware of Sister and you can introduce her here. Is this where Sister, where, or how did Sister become part of your practice?
So it's funny because again, I'm always looking for something new to do because I know if I get stagnant, I won't do well and I won't be effective. So I was part of the crisis response team for the county. So whenever there's a student death or a faculty member death or just some sort of whatever crisis comes up, they dispatch a team to that particular school and we're there for the students and the faculty and the community at large. So I was at one, a very popular, well-known high school student had passed away in a car accident. And we were sitting in the high school in the conference room and the kids were kind of coming through. We were doing our thing, but there wasn't a whole lot of talking and there wasn't a whole lot. It felt like something was missing. Like nobody knew quite what to say or how to, it was an odd dynamic there. And I remember just sitting there going, God, they should have a dog in here. And I was like, oh, Oh, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get a dog and I'm going to train it to be a therapy dog. So that started a whole nother journey for me. And it's still an ongoing journey, but I researched kennels and knew what I wanted. I wanted a bigger dog. I wanted a Labrador. So I found a kennel actually that's in Oxford, Mississippi. And they raise English Labradors, and with their temperament that they have, they're primarily gun dogs. But I'm not a hunter, but with the good temperament that they have, they make wonderful therapy dogs as well. So I was on a waiting list for a while for her, about 8 months. So at this point, COVID has started. So I got her in October of 2020. And I kept her, raised her up with this little puppy. And when she was 7 months old, I gave her back to the kennel for 5 months. And they did like really, really intensive obedience training with her. And because I can train a dog to sleep on the bed and sit down. That's all my knowledge of, they made me sweet, but I knew that she needed to have more than that. And then it's just been a progression since then. We've had to explain what therapy animals, their benefit, because a lot of people don't understand the benefit of them. We've had to write board policy to make sure that everybody's understanding what's going on. And it's not just, yes, she is my pet, but she has a purpose for that. So it's been a really neat transition over. Last year was her first full year with me in my schools. And they know her. They do not know me. Like, it's sister. And look, it's sister's mom. But it's been really neat because I got to know the students in a way that I never would have otherwise. Like, that was a talking point. So even students that maybe would never have been referred to me, I got to have contact with. And it's been wonderful, like getting to know staff more because everybody loves a dog and she just eats up the attention. So that's kind of the road to sister and having her in the schools with me.
Oh, that is such a beautiful story. And one of the things that I think I love most, because this is a social work platform, to get sister, it was micro, meso, and macro work. To get her not just to you and all the training, but then to be able to use her in the capacity that you would want her to be utilized. You not only are using her on a macro level, but you had to do the macro and meso work in order for the community and the boards to accept her into those spaces.
I remember being in my master's program and thinking, oh, policy, oh, it's too policy. But I have learned that policy drives everything. And if you can have a seat at the table, it makes all the difference in the world. So never discount it. It shows up everywhere in our profession.
Absolutely everywhere. I love that so much. Oh, I've loved listening about your journey. I have so many more questions, but I'm gonna transition on to my next question so that we can hear some more about you. So one of the big reasons I decided to start this podcast was to promote the importance of being in community with other social workers. So Julie, I'm wondering what social work communities do you belong to or that you created, and what have you learned about yourself being in those communities?
I think the most important thing that I've done is with the professional communities. I mean, I've been a member of NASW since my bachelor's program. It's painful to pay that every year, but the benefits that you get from it. Also, I am part of the Association for Play Therapy, the national organization, member of that. There's a state chapter that puts CEUs. I'm a member of the School Social Work Association of Georgia. I do in just our area, and I'm one of the officers in that area. So it's been broader, and I may not have name recognition in any of these particular areas and communities, but it's helped me figure out who I am and how I want to practice. So I encourage it totally. But I think in the smaller, more personal community is knowing which colleagues I can go to. Being a school social worker, it's very lonely because we're the only ones, and I have four schools, and I'm the only social worker in those four schools, and you start losing a sense of, what's my purpose? What's going on here? So to know who to bounce ideas off of, who to get supervision from, because that never ever goes away. That's been really important as well.
Oh, that was such a great point. I was about to jot it down, but even as LCSW, even as RPTS, even as Dr. Julie Lance, you say that you still need supervision. I do too, right? How do you, when, when we're getting it in our jobs and or because paying someone to be your supervisor, but now that you got all the letters, right? You talked about your earrings and your necklace that you're family guy, you have all the letters. Some would think, oh, I don't need supervision anymore. Why do you think that is so important, even after all the letters behind your name?
Because I still question my rhyme and reason when I interact with families and children. I definitely have that confidence level, but sometimes there are these things that come up and there's no right or wrong path. And you just kind of want to process it with somebody like, look, this is what's going on. This is what I did. Does that sound right to you? Did I miss something? Having that outside perspective that doesn't know those clients can really, really be helpful, or come up with resources that I never thought of, like, oh yeah, I should do that. So you don't stop learning in this profession. You just don't. There's I will always be learning in this profession.
Absolutely. And in fact, the CSWE, Council on Social Work Education, competency number one is social workers are lifelong learners, right? And especially when you're doing, I'm in a solo practice. Like you said, you have four schools and you're the only social worker. When you're so isolated like that, you can begin to have tunnel vision because all you have is your own thought process about how something should or shouldn't be done. And so accessing others, even if they're just your peers or colleagues, is so important to make sure you stay
And you have to
grounded.
be confident in your job, because everybody is gonna that is not a social worker is going to tell you how to do your job. Because they feel like they know better than you do. Because after a while, you can sort of make things look easy. It comes natural. It's like anybody can do that. And so, but knowing who I am and grounded in the profession that I'm in, to be able to kind of come right back and go, yeah, I'm not doing that, and this is the reason why. And that's okay to do. Boundaries, boundaries, boundaries.
Absolutely. And I love that you said that because we do make things look easy, don't we? We do. We make things look easy. I love that. That was so good. That was so good, Julie. The next question I have is, what is one belief about social work that you started on this journey with that you feel has changed the most?
It kind of goes back to what I was just saying, actually, is that, in starting out, you're a rookie and you know that you still have a lot to learn, but I at first had that thought process of it'll be easier when I'm further in my career. Like, this will be easier to do. And in some aspects, yes, because you do get more confidence and more of a knowledge base, but it in a lot of ways is not necessarily easier. So I had to kind of, reroute myself with that I'm never going to know it all. And when I was younger and starting out, I always was like, okay, well, I'll get these degrees and then I'll know it all. But you get to a point where you just sort of shift over to the other side, where you do have more knowledge base so that you can impart on others, but recognize that you don't know it all. I think that was important to learn.
Absolutely. And then, our clients are never the same. I've not ever, and I'm sure you could say the same thing, had one client who was identical to the next client. And so, knowing even that our client situation and however their situations mix up to create them is going to be different. And how we handle each client is going to be different. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love that. Julie, we're coming up to our last question already. I can't believe this has been such an amazing conversation. And you started and you said something about, when you were in high school, you pushed through and finished a year early. You got your LCSW literally just a few years post master's, which to me is amazing. You got your PhD. You're doing all these amazing things and you've accomplished a lot in your career. I often speak to younger social workers who are trying to do all the things in 1 year. Can you give any advice to social workers about being patient with themselves in this profession?
Right. So, in kind of going back to my first job at Grady, I knew that was not going to be my last stop. It was not going to be my first stop and last stop all in one. So I kind of, unconsciously, like I never said, I'm only going to do 3 years at Grady and move on. But it's just unconsciously, I knew this and tried to learn as much as I could in that position. And then I knew it. It was in my gut. I'm like, okay, it's time to go somewhere else. I've done what I can here and I'm gonna not learn or grow anymore. So that's when I would start looking for something else. So it's always been a step up and forward, not necessarily up in like pay or supervisor or anything like that, but for me, just a growth. It's been, well, what's my next step gonna be? What's my next step gonna be? I don't like being stagnant. And I'm always looking for something new to do.
That's the energy I was picking up on is like stagnation. Our social workers who feel like they're stuck, if they can have that proactive, let me learn. I love that you said that where you are at now is not a waste of time. Go ahead and learn everything you can where you are, knowing that it's going to prepare you for your next step.
In our career, and I said that earlier, just about the versatility of social work, you can go so many places and do so many things. The foundation that we have is what allows us to be able to, now I like kids. Maybe next year I'm going to want work with the elderly population. And it's all transferable. So, even if you're in child protective services right now, that doesn't mean that that's your end all be all. Take that knowledge, take that foundation, go somewhere else with it.
Absolutely. I love that so much. This is such a great conversation. Happy Social Work Month. I just love that we get to celebrate and, dialogue about social work. Thanks for coming on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.
Is wonderful. I love talking about it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. We are glad you were here. If you liked this episode, please come back to hear more stories of the journeys through social work and please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. See you next time here on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.